Thank you, Mr. Williams, and happy Sabbath, everyone. It's a little bit different Sabbath for us as well. To not be doing announcements is a little unusual, and to be here at 2 o'clock was unusual as well. We were not at Hickory this morning, so this is that one time of the year where we were only in Greensboro only, the way the schedule worked out, so we're very happy to be here and share the Sabbath with you. So I want to welcome to those who may be on the webcast. If you're with us, we're happy to have you, and hopefully, our friend Adolph Murdoch is watching the webcast. We were in his room visiting with him before services, and he had his little tablet ready to watch services. So I hope that Adolph's on. If you are, hello. He says he welcomes some visitors this afternoon after church if you'd like to go. So, again, I trust that you all did already receive the announcements in your email. If you did not, you can let me know, but I think everyone did receive those. One thing I would remind you of, that we do have Men's Club 10 minutes after services today. So, in our story presented during the first part of a three-part series, we recounted what it was like for the first and second generations after Joseph's death. The Israelites gradually found themselves going from farmers and shepherds, living an abundant life in Egypt, to helpless slaves cringing under the whip of ruthless taskmasters. It was not the life they expected for themselves. The new Egyptian pharaoh and his advisors had deceived them into thinking they were accepted and welcomed in their land despite their segregation. But in reality, they eventually began to be treated like animals. As we're going through these sermons, we have to think of the spiritual analogies for us today. Thinking back on the first sermon, sin will appear attractive and inviting, but once you're living in it, or living near it, you find its ultimate goal is to destroy you. We may look for a way out, and we find it's hopeless. It seems we have no choice but to remain trapped in sin. Most find there's not even another way to live. They aren't aware. They don't know. And so as we enter these days of unleavened bread very soon now, we've discovered that there is hope for us after all. God has had a plan for us all along, and it's beginning to be revealed to us. Come with me then back to ancient Israel, the land of Goshen, in Egypt, 1443 BCE. Our story begins again after the emotional meeting between Moses and Aaron at Mount Sinai. It was time to return to Egypt. And so Exodus 4, verse 29. Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. Remember, they had been on Mount Sinai. They had their reunion meeting there. Aaron finds out what's going on, and they go back to Egypt. Verse 30, Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. Suddenly, a voice shouted from the group of elders. Who do you think you are? How do you expect us to believe your crazy story about God speaking to you from a burning bush? Others also began to shout at Moses. How can you prove God sent you? God doesn't care about us anymore. He's left us here in slavery for over 150 years. Get out of here. We don't want any false hope. There's nothing you or anybody else can do to get us out of Egypt. Just go away. The crowd started toward Moses and Aaron to force them to leave. Moses raised his arm and shouted, "Stop! Listen to me. I can prove God sent me." The people stepped back, and as they did so, Moses threw his staff to the ground, and it immediately turned into a large snake. Those close by were stunned by what happened. "His staff became a snake," they shouted. Moses made everyone stand back away and form a huge circle around him so the others could also see the snake. And then after a few minutes, Moses approached the snake, grabbed it by its tail, and immediately it turned back into his rod. Unbelievable, the people gasped. But wait, Moses shouted to the crowd, there is more. And he raised his hand for all the people to see. Look at my hand, he said as he walked around the huge circle of the Israelite elders. Returning to the center of the circle, Moses then put his hand inside his cloak. When he pulled it back out, his hand was riddled with leprosy. Moses approached some nearby men and they began to fall back in terror. Get away, they shouted. Now, see the power of God at work. And Moses said that as he thrust his leprous hand back into his cloak. Quickly withdrawing his hand again, Moses held it high to show the people his hand was now completely normal and clean. What kind of magic is this? Someone shouted. That's right. This is just magic. I've seen Pharaoh's magicians do magic tricks like this before. This man, Moses, he's just a magician. He's trying to trick us into following him. Moses glanced over to Aaron. Go get the large jar of water, Aaron. A few minutes later, Aaron and some other men placed the jar of water in the center of the circle. Moses asked some of the elders to come forward and see what's in the jar. It's just water, they confirmed. Now, see, the power of the true God is with me, Moses shouted. He and Aaron pushed over the jar and the water poured out all over the ground. Just then, Moses touched the tip of his staff into the pooling water, and instantly all the water became blood. Some of it flowed onto the feet of the men standing nearby. This is blood. Moses has turned the water into blood. There can be no doubt. This man has proven to us that he has been sent to us with the power of God. Verse 31. And so the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel and that he had looked on their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshiped. For many, it was the first time in a long time. Joe Israelite, the great-great-great-grandson of the Joe Israelite we met in 1581 BCE, can't wait to get home to tell his family what has happened today. The God of our fathers has returned. He sent a man to free us from Egypt, he told his wife, Rebecca. We're going to be free. But they had no idea what was to happen first. The year 1443 BCE, chapter 5, verse 1. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness." And Pharaoh said, "Who's the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go." And so they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with sword." And the king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their work? Get back to your labors." So Pharaoh sent them away. Moses and Aaron were disappointed at this unexpected result. Not only had they been rejected, but Pharaoh now decided to make life even more unbearable for the Israelites. Verse 10. The taskmasters of the people and their officers went out and spoke to the people, saying, "Thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go get yourselves straw wherever you can find it. Yet none of your work will be reduced." And so the people were scattered abroad throughout all the land of Egypt, at least where they could walk, to gather stubble instead of straw. And the taskmasters forced them to hurry, saying, "Fulfill your work, your daily quota as when there was straw given. The officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, "Why have you not fulfilled your task in making brick both yesterday and today as before? Get busy." News of this new requirement reached the elders from the Egyptian officers even before Moses and Aaron could make their way back to the camp. The elders were determined to banish Moses and Aaron because of Pharaoh's edict. Verse 21, "Let the Lord look on you and judge you, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in his hand to kill us. Get out of here. Leave us before we're all dead." And the people went back to work. Joe Israelite's life was made even more miserable than before. His back was scarred from the continuous beatings. "How can we work any faster? This is impossible," he told his wife as he set out for yet another trip for the long stalks of stubble in the field. This was not supposed to happen. God sent us to free the people, and instead, their suffering is worse. So Moses decided to ask God what to do. And God told him to speak to the people again. And so Moses gathered the elders and as many people as could possibly hear him, and he said, "Listen to me, Israel. God has spoken to me. Listen to what he has said." Verse 6. "God said to me to tell you, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. And I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brings you out from under the burden of the Egyptians. And I will bring you into the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I will give it to you as a heritage. I am the Lord." Standing near the back of the crowd was Joe Israelite. How can anybody believe this man? He promised us freedom. Pharaoh's made it worse. Why doesn't he just go away and leave us alone? In fact, that's what everybody around him thought. And everyone started shouting at Moses, "We don't believe you. Get out of here. Quit giving our people false hope." Moses and Aaron were filled with sorrow for the people. "Why wouldn't they believe us?" Aaron said. "If our own people won't listen to us, how can we expect Pharaoh to pay any attention to us?" But Moses knew the answer was with God. And so he asked God yet again what he should do next. Chapter 5, verse 22. And so Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Why is it that you sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's done evil to these people. And neither have you delivered your people at all. You didn't do what you said you were going to do." And God reminded Moses once again of the covenant that he had made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God told Moses that he must still speak all the things that he commanded him to speak before the Pharaoh. But this time, God encouraged Moses with this promise. Chapter 7, verse 1. The Lord said, "Moses, I'm going to make you like God to the king. And your brother Aaron will speak to him like your prophet. You're going to speak to him with my authority and with a right to command his obedience and with strength to enforce my commands." Verse 3, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And I'll multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not heed you, so that I might lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by my great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. Moses and Aaron were encouraged by these powerful words from God. So Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord God commanded them, so they did. And Moses and Aaron returned to the palace. This time, Pharaoh asked Moses for proof that he was a representative from God. And as previously instructed, Moses now threw his rod down, and once again it became a large snake. And when Pharaoh's magicians did the same thing, Moses' snake, the first snake, devoured all the others. But Pharaoh was not impressed, and he sent Moses and Aaron away. The plagues on Egypt are about to begin. While we don't have the time to thoroughly describe all of the first nine plagues that were to be unleashed on the Egyptians, still I hope you can grasp a vision of what it must have been like. Imagine seeing the entire Nile River becoming a river flowing with real blood. As that happened, soon a horrible stench filled the air as multiple thousands of fresh fish died in the waters. In a matter of hours, the people began to panic as they realized there's no fresh water available. It seemed all the water everywhere had become blood. So either the Egyptians had to bring water in from outside their borders or get it by digging for springs far away from the banks of the Nile, or they had none. Soon, animals began to die of thirst, followed also by some Egyptians who were just unable to find water. Their suffering was terrible. But this was just the beginning. After 7 days, the water began to return to normal, and the Nile flowed with fresh water once again. The people were relieved. So was Pharaoh. When Moses and Aaron returned with their renewed request to let the people go, Pharaoh once again refused. And you know the story. The next morning, there were frogs everywhere. And the plagues were to continue, one after another. Next, it was lice or fleas crawling everywhere on their skin, the terrible itching, stinging. Meanwhile, Joe, Israelite, and his family were also beginning to wonder, what's happening? What's Moses doing? Because they were affected by these plagues also. Was the God of Moses trying to destroy them? I thought Moses said we were going to be delivered from Egypt, not suffer with them. Can we trust Moses? At least we don't have to go out and gather straw and make bricks and continue working on those buildings. There's no guards with whips anywhere to be found. And the plagues were to continue. But now God was about to show both the Israelites and the Egyptians a powerful witness. A plague of flies was to come next. But this time, things were going to be different. Chapter 8, verse 22. And in that day, I will set apart the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarm of flies shall be there, in order that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the land. I will make a difference between my people and your people. And tomorrow this sign shall be. And so vast swarms of large biting flies descended on Egypt, but not in the adjacent land of Goshen where the Israelites lived. from then on, none of the coming plagues would affect them. It may be that they experienced the first two plagues because of their unbelief, and to also see firsthand the power of God. But regretfully, Pharaoh had no concern for his people and for their suffering. He would outlast Moses and his God. Nothing could bring him down, and nothing could make him grant this foolish request of Moses to let his slaves go. But next, it was to be something different. This time, the plague wasn't on the people. It was on the animals. All kinds of livestock belonging to the Egyptians died quickly from a terrible disease. The cattle in the field, the horses, the donkeys, the camels, the oxen, the sheep. So many of them died. And then soon, a day or two later, began to decay. The putrid smell of death was overwhelming. And the plagues continued. The next one was going to bring severe pain. Suddenly their bodies were covered with painful sores or boils. And Pharaoh again sent for Moses, only to find out from Moses that God was sparing his life so that he could continue to witness the power of God. And Moses told Pharaoh, "Hailstones are coming next." And Pharaoh scoffed. "I've seen hailstones before. If that's all your God is capable of doing, bring them on." And he was about to be surprised. Chapter 9, verse 23. "And Moses stretched out his rod towards heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and fire darted to the ground, and the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt. So there was hail and fire mingled with the hail, so very heavy that there was nothing like it in all the land of Egypt since it had become a nation. And the hail struck throughout the entire land of Egypt, all that was in the field, both man and beast, and the hail struck every herb of the field and broke every tree of the field. The result? The animals are mostly all dead, except those who may have been in barns. Tens of thousands of Egyptians are now dead. There is suffering and devastation everywhere. Pharaoh is not convinced. Soldiers were dispatched to buy or steal some livestock and horses from bordering nations. But yet another plague. This time, locusts, chapter 10, verse 5. "They shall eat the residue of whatever is left, and there wasn't much, which remains to you from the hail. And they shall eat every tree which grows up for you out in the field. And they shall fill up your houses," verse 15, "so there remained nothing green on the trees or on the plants of the field throughout all the land of Egypt." Pharaoh's advisors were very worried. Verse 7, Pharaoh's servants said to him, "How long shall this man be a snare to us? Let them go that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed? Let them go, Pharaoh." Apparently not. Because Pharaoh once again refuses. The ninth plague comes. And it is terrible and fearsome, as everywhere, all around them, it suddenly goes black. Verse 22. "Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days." They couldn't. It was absolute darkness. and more people died from hunger and thirst. The rotting smell of death filled the air everywhere, and there was nothing anybody could do but sit and wait for the light to return. It was 3 days later. 3 days of horrible suffering. Once again, Pharaoh shouts for Moses to get out and take the people. But he quickly changes his mind. And so with great solemnity, Moses now begins to describe to Pharaoh that God will indeed send one more final plague. Chapter 11, verse 4. And Moses said, "Thus says the Lord, about midnight I will go out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the female servant who is behind the handmill, and the firstborn of all the animals, and there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as was not like it before, nor shall ever be again." Pharaoh's servants heard Moses' terrifying words. "You've got to listen to him. This is a man sent from God. He has great power that we cannot withstand. Shall we all die? Pharaoh, we can't bury the dead now. Listen to Moses. Let the Israelites go." Chapter 11, verse 3. "The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt. He was great in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of all the people." But Pharaoh only laughed to scorn. "You and your God can't touch me. I'm God." Moses looked back at Pharaoh and said, "All these your servants shall come down to me and will bow down to me saying, 'Get out,' and all the people who follow you. And only after that, I will get out." And Moses turned and walked away in anger and in sorrow at what Pharaoh had doomed his nation to suffer. And then God began to explain to Moses what he was going to do and how the people of Israel were to be protected from the coming death plague that would slay the firstborn of Egypt. After Moses received his instructions, he called for the elders of Israel to assemble to hear the news. Chapter 12, verse 21. "Pick out and take lambs for yourselves according to your families, and kill the lamb, the Passover lamb. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that's in the basin, and strike the lintel in the two doorposts with the blood that's in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of his house until morning. For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to strike you." News of what was about to happen spread quickly among the people. Joe Israelite could not believe what he was hearing. That evening, he began to explain to Rebekah and their children about what was going to happen. It all seemed so impossible. Nothing like this had ever happened before. Joe said to Rebekah, "Well, we've seen how God has spared us from most of the plagues on the Egyptians. We just have to trust him that he's going to spare us from this one too." Joe's little son, Eli, his firstborn son, looked up at his father and he said, "Father, I'm scared. What do you mean by all this? Father, I don't understand." And Joe smiled lovingly at his little boy. "It'll be all right, son. We were told to call it the Passover sacrifice of the Lord. He will pass over the houses of all the people tonight when he strikes the firstborn of the Egyptians. But he'll spare all of our households. We don't need to be afraid. It'll be all right." And with that, Joe led his family in prayer as they bowed their heads and worshiped God for the first time in a long time. "Oh Lord God, we had forgotten you, but you have not forgotten us. Thank you for this promise of freedom you have brought through your servant Moses." And Joseph and Rebekah wept with joy. Still, Joe could not help but worry. This is just too good to be true. The next day, Joe Israelite and his family selected the lamb from among the flock that would be used for the blood and the special meal that Moses had told them about. He was with his little boy Eli, and so Eli says, "This one, father?" "No, son. Not that one. That one has a mark on him, and he can't be used. No, the lamb has to be just right. How about this little guy?" "Oh, he's very cute, isn't he, father?" said Eli. "Yes, son. He's cute. We can keep him in the house for 4 days now. But then, Eli, this lamb will have to be our sacrifice to God." And Eli was very sad to think about that. And so they kept the lamb, played with him for 4 days. But finally, in the late afternoon of the 13th of Nisan, as sunset approached, Joe gathered his family around. "It's almost time," he said. His wife and all the others had been told to prepare unleavened bread and unsweetened vegetables and herbs to eat with this lamb. "They'll all be ready soon," Rebecca said. "Good," replied Joseph. "But now is the time for us to change into the clothes we'll be wearing for our long journey." In about an hour, the sun had set. The 14th of Nisan had begun. "It's time," Joseph said. "Eli, pick up the little lamb in your arms, bring him to me, and let's go outside." "No," he cried. "Abba, no, please don't kill our little lamb. I love him." And tears started streaming down Joe's face too. "I know, son. I know. I love him too. But we must obey God. The blood of this lamb put on our doorpost. Eli, it's the only thing that will save your life tonight from God's wave of death that's coming on all the firstborn in the land." And so with that, Joseph slit the throat of the precious little lamb. In a few moments, he lay motionless, and his blood filled the basin that had been prepared to collect it. And Eli cried for the lamb. And Joe painted their doorpost with its blood. Before long, the meal was ready. They shared part of their meal with an elderly couple who lived next to them. And they all talked quietly about what was to happen. An eerie silence had come over the community. Nobody was outside now because they had been warned not to leave their homes all night. But as midnight approached, the silence was broken. Screams of anguish began to be heard from the homes of the nearby Egyptian families. Chapter 12, verse 29. "It came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. And so Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians. And there was a great cry in Egypt. for there was not a house where there was not one that was dead. And Joe Israelite gathered his family close to him. "Let's try to get some sleep now," he said. "We have much to do in the morning." And so it seemed they had barely closed their eyes when Joe and his wife were awakened by loud voices and knocking at the door. "Get out of here," they were yelling. "Leave us before we're all dead." Joe and Rebecca looked at each other. "It's some Egyptians," he said. "Rebecca, it's true. It's actually going to happen, just like Moses said. We're leaving Egypt today." So Joe and his family went outside and found several Egyptians who had brought loaded wagons filled with all kinds of supplies. Also, there were several carts loaded with large trunks. "Take all this," an Egyptian man said. "This is all yours. It's certainly not doing us any good. We're all as good as dead anyway." So Joe looked inside one of the trunks. To his surprise, it was filled with gold and silver vessels. "Why, this must be worth a fortune," he said to his wife. Rebecca looked inside another trunk and found beautiful, expensive clothing. "Well, there's plenty more where this came from," the Egyptian said. "Whatever you want, just take it." Verse 33. And the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste, for they said, "We shall all be dead." And the children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, and they had asked from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. But the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they granted them whatever they requested. And thus they plundered the Egyptians. All the rest of that day, Joe and his family made their final preparations. Most of the time was spent gathering the wagons and carts and loading up all the treasures that the Egyptians had brought to them. "Eli, you and your little brother and sister, go gather the sheep, bring them to the front of the house." Joe went to round up the dozen cattle or so that he still had foraging out in the field for food. It was getting late in the afternoon. Rebecca had been so busy, she had not taken any time to prepare any food. It's okay," Joe told her. "Just bring your mixing pans along with the meal and the flour and the oil. We'll eat tonight." Just then, a series of long trumpet blasts began to sound throughout the plains. "That's it," Joe shouted. "That's the signal. It's time to go." And shouts of joy rose up from all the families surrounding Joe Israelite. "Can you believe it?" they shouted. "We're free, we're free." And Joe gathered up his family and put the children up on the cart being drawn by two oxen. And he looked at Rebecca, tears filling his eyes. "Oh, we've suffered so much, but it's over. Let's go to the promised land. They say it flows with milk and honey." And with that, Joe and his wife began to walk away from what had been their home for generations. And Joe thought to himself, "I'll remember this night for the rest of my life. This is 430 years to the day since God reconfirmed his special covenant with their almost forgotten ancestor named Abraham." Instructions had been received for all the families in the many Israelite communities throughout the land of Goshen that they were to make their way as quickly as possible toward the Egyptian city of Ramses. Before long, they could no longer see their village behind them. But what they began to see coming from all different directions was what seemed to be a never-ending line of people, cattle, and various other livestock, and wagons and carts. "Just look at all these people," Joe exclaimed. "Oh, there's so many of us." Actually, Joe and his family really had no idea just how many Israelites there were throughout this land of Goshen, because all they'd ever known was their own little community, because their taskmasters had made them work from dawn to dark every day. Walk to the job site. Walk out to where you can find the grain stubble. Come back. Work all day. Walk home. Try to sleep. Repeat. And that was it. Day after day. Month after month. Year after year. Really no realization that this existence was being repeated in Israelite communities several miles away. Or just how many Israelites there really were. Joe Israelite and his family, as were most families, were kept isolated from the other Israelites because the Egyptians feared a rebellion if they were ever allowed to assemble together in large groups. But now Joe and the other Israelite families were able to see that they indeed were a vast army of people now headed toward Ramses. Well, there are tens of thousands of us, Joe said. I had no idea. Joe still had no idea how many there were. As they finally were beginning to approach the city of Ramses, the full moon was shining brightly above them. It was about this time the trumpets began to sound again and the people stopped. A man on horseback came riding towards their group and several other riders could be seen as well. You must organize your families, the man shouted to them. Stay with your tribe. Form into small units of 50 families who will travel together under the leadership of a captain. Lift up a banner identifying your group for all around you to see, and then you follow that banner. We have to stay together as an organized group as we approach and march through Ramses. Joe and the others around him agreed that this made sense and quickly made sure they were following the directions given. Within about an hour, Joe and his family found themselves walking through the center of this once majestic and beautiful city that now lies in ruins. Look at this devastation, he gasped. The power of God has destroyed this city. And it was the same everywhere they looked. No plant life, no grass, toppled trees, smashed buildings, carcasses of dead animals and people lying on the ground. The light of hundreds of small fires could be seen flickering throughout the city. The foul stench of death filled the air. What few people that were out on the streets begged for food or begged to be allowed to go with them. Take me with you. What's happened here? Eli asked his father. God has shown his mercy, and he set us free from slavery to these Egyptians, son. We're free men now. We're going to a new home. Eli, never forget what you are seeing tonight. We'll celebrate this night as long as we live. And with that, Joe Israelite and his family, along with a vast multitude of others, began to leave the city of Ramses. But standing up on the wall next to the gate stood a man with his hands up in the air, holding a staff in one hand. Look, son, that's Moses. That's the man God has chosen to lead us to the promised land. Verse 37. Then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot. Besides children, a mixed multitude went up with them also, flocks and herds, a great deal of livestock. And so they walked all that night, and it seemed as if it were a miracle. Nobody was too tired to walk. Even the older, feeble men and women found that they had renewed strength. Early in the morning, a messenger arrived near Joe Israelite and his group. I have a message from Moses, he said. Everybody listen to me. This is the message that Moses has for all of us, for all of Israel. Exodus 12, verse 3. Remember this day in which you went up out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. For by strength of hand, the Lord has brought you out of this place. no leavened bread shall be eaten. On this day you are going out in the month of Abib. And it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, Amorites, Hivites, and Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land that is flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. And on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days. No leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And then you tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up out of Egypt. And it shall be a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt, and you shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. And when the messenger concluded these words, he said, you will rest today. We will continue our journey at sunset. And all the families around Joe agreed, we need a day of rest anyway. And we are very hungry. Maybe we'll enjoy this unleavened flat bread. The next day, after traveling about 8 miles, they arrived at a place known as Sukkoth. It was already late in the afternoon. Everyone was very tired and needed to rest again. There were so many people that despite the occasional stop to rest, some people were always moving. Their captain was already encouraging them to start up again after just a few hours of rest. And now they were headed to a location known as Etham. Etham, Joe said. This is not exactly the way I thought we might be traveling. He expressed this to his traveling companions. I thought we'd be heading northeast, but we're traveling to the south. Exodus 13, verse 17. God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. And so God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. That's just it, Joe's friend said. How are we supposed to know exactly where to go out here? This wilderness, there's so many of us. We're heading out into the desert land. What if we get lost out here? A few hours later, Joe's friend and everyone else throughout the camp of Israel was going to get a very unexpected answer. A small white cloud appeared on the horizon of the eastern sky. Nothing unusual about that. But over the next few minutes, the cloud grew larger and larger and began to extend higher and higher like a massive pillar rising above them. It was high enough in the sky that all the Israelites, now over 2.5 million of them, could clearly see it. Before long, a messenger again came toward Joe's campsite. He blew a trumpet to get the attention of the people everywhere around. And he said, this cloud will be our guide. This cloud is the very presence of God, he said. When it moves, we move. When it stops, we stop. Tonight, when the sun is set, something will happen. This cloud will transform into a bright pillar, a blazing fire, and God will provide light and warmth for us. And God will show us the way to the promised land. Chapter 13, verse 21. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day or night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. And the people of Israel were amazed. How powerful is this God? Where has he been all these years? Why do we have to live in slavery for so long? And now, the God of Moses is showing us His great power to free us from Egypt. Will God stay with us? Will He really take us all the way to the land promised to our forefathers? Is this too good to be true? I want to do the right thing. I want to do what's right for my family, but can I really trust Moses out here in this desert wilderness after all? These thoughts of doubt filled the mind of Joe Israelite as it was time once again to start walking. What have we learned from this part of the Exodus story today? And what does all this have to do with our observance of the days of unleavened bread? God has His own timetable in dealing with us. Even when God seems to be absent or far away, He is not. There was a time in our lives when we were hopelessly in slavery to sin. It had a tight grip on us. There was nothing we could do to escape it. We have all sinned. We had all come under the penalty of death, and there was nothing to look forward to but eventual death, eternal death. That price of our sins had to be paid. But at some time in our lives, we received a message. We received a special calling from God. He showed us His presence in our lives after all. And we were given a choice to make. Remain in sin, where I'm comfortable, or follow the path out of sin that leads to a promised land. I have never known anything else. And most of us have chosen to take the path that was revealed to us. When that decision is first made, oh, there's great joy, anticipation. God's calling me to a wonderful life. Everything's going to be great. And this journey, oh, it's going to be easy after all. It's a short distance. How do we know? How do we know it's easy? Because, well, we see God's hand evident all around us now. Well, there's miracles of God. He's working wonderful miracles in our lives. He's helped me keep my job despite needing off for the Sabbath. He's helped me have a better marriage. Oh, yes, God is with me. Yes, He is. And you've come to realize that you could have never done any of this on your own. You could have never done it without Him. There's no way you could have made this journey out of sin to a new way. You now realize the price that was paid for you to be able to follow Jesus Christ to the promised land. It took His shed blood. That innocent little lamb that did not deserve to die. And you cry to realize it. You're now determined to follow Him wherever He leads because He's proven to you that He loves you. And you're going to start that journey with His help. I think I'm ready to go. I think I can successfully make this journey. And so you take the first steps. But just as you start your journey to follow Jesus Christ with great joy and anticipation, the path makes an unexpected turn to the south. It's not going where you thought. Despite your initial obedience and enthusiasm, this new unexpected direction begins to fill you with doubt. And so we'll pick it up there. Part 3 in the next and final sermon in the series as we examine what it was like to be trapped at the Red Sea and then conclude the story of the Exodus from Egypt with the golden calf and the evil report of the spies.